Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. As Floridians know, this hurricane season is brutal. In Cuba, Hurricane Ian knocked out power to the entire island. Emergency managers and meteorologists say they need to change how they talk about the weather.
I think we need a new playbook when it comes to rapidly intensifying storms.
Also, we speak with a U.S. senator who wants more answers about the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh.
If protecting journalists is a top priority and protecting American citizens is a top priority, this is a clear case where the Biden administration has to show that it means what it says.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, women in Iran are rising up, using smartphones to outsmart the morality police.
One reason the morality police is there because they've never really have been able to fully control the women of Iran.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us today. Russian President Vladimir Putin is set to formally annex four territories from Ukraine tomorrow. The move comes after Kremlin-backed officials orchestrated referendums in the occupied territories. If it feels like deja vu, you're not wrong. Moscow used the same playbook in 2014. That's when pro-Russian forces took control of the Crimean Peninsula. Then Kremlin-backed officials tried to make it look credible by overseeing a chaotic referendum with no international observers. To help us think about the parallels between that 2014 vote and what's happening now in these Russian-occupied Ukrainian territories, we reached out to Bill Taylor. Ambassador Taylor has been the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine twice, most recently under President Trump. Ambassador, take us back to 2014, if you would. Remind us what the Russian strategy of a referendum followed by annexation in Crimea looked like.
So, Marco, what it looked like was a surprise. No one expected President Putin to invade his neighbor, and at first, he denied it. President Putin denied that these were actually Russian soldiers that had just taken over the Crimean Peninsula, part of Ukraine. I mean, he sent these soldiers in without insignia, and there was not significant military pushback. And they moved to establish some kind of hold after they finally admitted that it was actually Russians by using this referendum. In 2014, this referendum was conducted at the barrel of a gun. People were forced to vote. People were not allowed to oppose. There was one question on the ballot, and if you got the wrong answer, bad things happened to you. You disappeared. It could have been worse. So this was announced, the Russians announced that they had 97% of Crimeans that wanted to join Russia. Ludicrous, ludicrous, but very similar to these referenda that we're seeing today. The big difference, though, Marco, is today the Ukrainians are prepared. And no one will recognize these current referenda and the current Russian claims to Donetsk and Luhansk and Kherson and Zaporizhia. No one will recognize it. And most importantly, Marco, the Ukrainians don't recognize it. The Ukrainians know that these provinces are part of their country, and they will continue to fight and push the Russians out of their country.
So let's stay in 2014 for a moment. I mean, annexation, it's serious business. How did U.S. officials respond in 2014?
They responded slowly, frankly. There were denunciations. Eventually, there were some sanctions against those Russian officials who were responsible for this invasion and this referendum back in 2014. But it was not a full-blown, certainly not a military response. It was slow. The Americans had to push to get other nations, European nations, to join in the sanctions. But frankly, it was not a robust response, unlike today.
So you said no one will recognize this annexation, except that Russia does say it's legitimately their land now. How could Putin defend this territory that he considers Russia?
He can say what he wants, Marco. He can say that it was really 99% of the people in Kherson that really wanted to join Russia. Everyone knows that is a lie. So let the Russians say what they want. No one will believe them.
Right. No one will believe them. But what actions could Putin take to defend that territory that he, in his mind, believes is Russian?
Probably no more, but no less than what he's doing right now. He's trying to take over that territory and so far is failing. So he'll try to continue. He'll try to keep pushing this partial mobilization that he's trying to implement in Russia, 300,000 or more he's trying to get. Probably that many Russians have already left Russia in response to that attempt to mobilize.
So, Ambassador, what do you think this will mean, this annexation will mean for the everyday life of people living in those territories? I mean, men are going to be conscripted, right?
Men are going to be tried to be conscripted, and they will resist. They will resist. The Ukrainians who live in these territories are not going to willingly go into the Russian army and fight fellow Ukrainians. They're not going to do it. You're going to continue to see the partisan warfare striking back against the Russians and any Russian collaborators that are on the Ukrainian side.
So in 2022, what does Russia actually hope to achieve with this strategy of referendum and annexation? Is it simply their distorted facts on the ground, or is there something else we're missing?
President Putin knows he's losing on the ground. He probably understands he's losing with the Russian people. So this is a trick. This is an attempt to tell the Russians, actually, now these are really Russian lands. And Russian lands will defend even stronger than we've been defending before. He will have to admit that he's not been very successful in pushing into these Russian lands. So now by some trick, he is going to tell them this is actually now, by virtue of these fake referenda, Russian lands that we're now defending and pushing back on.
So looking back at 2014 and the annexation of Crimea, do you see missed opportunities on the diplomatic front? How might the U.S. and its allies have countered Russia at that moment?
Militarily, it would have been very difficult. The Ukrainians were not in a position to push back. And if they're not in a position to push back, then NATO and the United States military were not in a position to do that. Diplomatically, we could have taken stronger measures. What we did say, and what Secretary Pompeo said, which was a very strong statement, he said the United States will never recognize Russian annexation of Crimea. And we've said the same thing this time. It took some time to build up the Ukrainian military's capability to respond. That's the response, Marco. It's not a diplomatic one. It is a military response that the Ukrainians are mounting to push the Russians back out of their country.
Diplomatically and politically today, should the West be doing anything else aside from saying we will not recognize these referendums?
Yes, there are things that we should be doing more. We should be providing more weapons, more ammunition, more intelligence, more military support to the Ukrainians so that they can win. The Ukrainians know they can win. I was there 3 weeks ago. I talked to Ukrainians. I talked to them every day since. They know they can win. But this has to be done with the military that they've got there now with our support.
I'm curious, does this new annexation of these Russian-occupied territories in Ukraine, does it reopen the question of Crimea's future?
I think it does. I think the Ukrainians have made it clear over the past months, they still recognize Crimea as part of Ukraine, and the Ukrainians have attacked military targets in Crimea. This caused panic to the Russians in Crimea. They fled. They headed for that one bridge that goes from Crimea back into Russia. They were panicked by these attacks that the Ukrainians mounted against Russian forces in Crimea. So the Russians now know that the Ukrainians will continue to threaten them and attack them, and eventually the Ukrainians are convinced they will get Crimea back.
Ambassador Bill Taylor has been the top U.S. diplomat in Ukraine twice, most recently under President Trump. He's now executive vice president at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Ambassador, great to have you on again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Vice President Kamala Harris is in South Korea. Today she toured the heavily fortified border with North Korea, the DMZ or demilitarized zone. The North Korean government is usually unhappy about high-profile Americans coming so close to its soil. In advance of Harris's visit, the North fired two missiles into the sea yesterday. South Korea's government called that provocative. But it was not enough for U.S. and South Korean officials to cancel the vice president's trip. The World's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen has been following the story. Patrick, American leaders have visited the DMZ over the years. What was the goal with this visit by Vice President Harris at this particular moment?
Yeah, well, North Korea is getting pretty feisty these days regarding its nuclear weapons. They've been refining their arsenal, testing out an improved class of missiles. As you mentioned, they fired off two yesterday. I'm seeing reports they just fired another one, so that would be several hours after the VP's visit to the DMZ. They've done roughly 30 missile launches this year alone. So as for Kamala Harris's visit, it's a symbolic way to show toughness to North Korea. She called North Korea a brutal dictatorship, which for a White House official is on the harsher side, though not unprecedented. And she came just a few meters from North Korean soil. It is the most high-profile DMZ visit since Donald Trump went in 2019. And as you might remember, Marco, he actually walked into North Korea very briefly. Kamala Harris did not. Right. The vice president also wanted to show that the U.S. and South Korea have a, quote, ironclad alliance, and that both countries want to see a totally denuclearized North Korea. As time goes on, Marco, that is looking more and more like an impossible goal.
I mean, the big question when it comes to U.S. policy toward North Korea is always around the country's nuclear weapons program, a question that rarely has a clear answer. How is Harris's trip expected to move the needle on the effort to denuclearize North Korea?
It certainly shows that the U.S. and South Korea have solidarity on that front. Actually, the U.S. and South Korea are doing joint military drills as we speak with an aircraft carrier, so a very large-scale exercise. As for reducing the number of North Korean nukes, that is moving in the wrong direction. Kim Jong-un just verified through a new North Korean law that North Korea could preemptively launch nuclear strikes against its enemies. We have to take this with a grain of salt, but U.S. and South Korean intelligence both say they have evidence that Kim Jong-un will test another nuclear bomb this year. And if that does happen, Marco, that would be the first in 5 years. So really, the vice president's trip, it doesn't change that much. North Korea is still a nuclear-armed state, and the chance of progress is pretty low.
Vice President Harris is also meeting with South Korea's new president, Yoon Suk-yeol. How is that being covered in South Korea?
Well, this is interesting. President Yoon is on the right wing in South Korea, and he campaigned as a hardline U.S. supporter. He even called his rival wimpy and unwilling to really join the U.S. in standing up to North Korea. So this should be a layup, right? But instead, he's doing damage control because Yoon, a few days ago at a UN meeting, was caught on a hot mic calling the U.S. Congress idiots. He was actually referring to the entire Congress. This is actually a big scandal in South Korea. So the meeting with Harris could help him move past that. The other complication is that Yoon has previously called himself an anti-feminist, saying gender discrimination does not exist. So in Seoul, Harris met with a group of successful Korean women, an athlete, a CEO, an actor. And this wasn't a direct rebuke to Yoon, but it was a way of pushing back against his anti-feminist statements.
Yeah, no doubt people noticed that. Finally, Patrick, regarding another story in another place in Asia, and that is the Biden administration's diplomatic efforts toward Pacific nations. The White House is holding a summit this week with a dozen regional countries. The Solomon Islands, apparently reluctant to sign off on a joint declaration. What's the issue and how big of a deal is it?
Right. Well, this is actually the result of really strong efforts by China to court the Solomon Islands, which is a very tiny country of just 600,000 people. The Solomon Islands have received very little attention from the U.S., and that's given Beijing officials the opportunity to swoop in over the last 3 years and try to bring the Solomon Islands closer to its orbit. China even signed a security pact with the islands, which could lead to building a military base, though that would be a long ways off. So now China is seeing that engagement bear fruit. When the White House wants the Solomon Islands to sign this declaration, which is about climate change and security and other issues, they are showing reluctance to just jump in and sign whatever the U.S. comes up with. And I think you can interpret that as them saying, well, hold on, we don't have to rush into anything that will jeopardize our friendship with China, which seems to really have our backs these days.
Patrick Nguyen, the World's Asia correspondent based in Bangkok. Thanks, as always, Patrick.
Thank you, Marco.
Coming up on the show, the lessons we're already learning from hurricanes like Ian about climate change and emergency response. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Hurricane Ian has caused incomprehensible damage in Florida since yesterday. The deadly storm system had accelerated across the Caribbean, evolving rapidly from a tropical storm into a strong Category 4 hurricane. That's happening more frequently these days, and there's an emerging scientific consensus that this is linked to climate change. As the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports, it's causing emergency managers and meteorologists to rethink how they communicate.
On Tuesday night, Hurricane Ian was a Category 3 storm.
It is just a kind of a damp, breezy, rainy night around Tampa Bay. Nothing severe yet.
By yesterday morning, things had changed, as reported on the local Fox station.
But you're looking at a Category 4 hurricane here, even though officially...
Just days earlier, in the Pacific Ocean, peak wind speeds for Typhoon Noru went up 105 miles per hour in just 24 hours before making landfall in the Philippines. It's part of a trend scientists call rapid intensification.
Yes, when we look at the statistics of hurricanes globally over the last 40 years or so, we do see a tendency for storms to intensify more rapidly.
Atmospheric scientist Carrie Emanuel says warmer ocean temperatures are helping fuel this trend.
So two things are happening. The peak wind speed is going up, and the time it takes storms to get there actually goes down.
Emanuel is a professor emeritus at MIT. He says over the years, scientists have gotten much better at forecasting the path of a storm, but it's still harder to predict how intense it will become.
It's a really big operational problem, rapid intensification. So, you know, the nightmare that forecasters have is to go to bed one night with a tropical storm in the Gulf of Mexico and wake up the next morning with a Cat 4 bearing down on the coast.
That's close to what happened last August with Hurricane Ida in the Gulf of Mexico. It intensified from a Category 1 storm on a Saturday morning to close to a Category 5 in less than 24 hours. In New Orleans, Mayor LaToya Cantrell announced on that Saturday that there wasn't enough time to get everyone out of the city.
Therefore, the city cannot issue a mandatory evacuation because we don't have the time. Hunker down. It is vitally important.
26 people in Louisiana died during Hurricane Ida and its aftermath.
I think we need a new playbook when it comes to rapidly intensifying storms.
Marshall Shepard is the director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia, and he points out it can take days to evacuate a city.
With a rapidly intensifying hurricane, if we can't evacuate people, do we need hardened shelters in those cities? Do we need to think carefully about other ways to approach this process?
Emergency managers in Florida did start reassessing their evacuation plans after Ida, says Claire Connolly Knox. She studies and teaches hurricane emergency responses at the University of Central Florida.
It brought to the attention of all the emergency managers and planners going, you know what, if we were in that scenario, we would be in the same situation as New Orleans.
Meteorologist John Morales says he has retained his calm, no-hype approach even as climate change supercharges hurricanes. But something is shifting in his local NBC broadcasts in Miami and forecasts for Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic.
What is changing for me is that now when I see a low-end tropical storm that is forecast across through a favorable area,
meaning an area with winds and a warm sea surface temperature that might fuel rapid intensification,
I'm going to be very suspicious of each one of those systems, even if they're just bottom-of-the-barrel tropical disturbances that in years past I might have not paid much attention to.
Morales says that suspicion translates to forcefully communicating the risks that a benign storm might quickly transform into something much more dangerous, a message he started stressing last week before Ian was even named a hurricane. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
In Iran, a certain phone app is in huge demand right now. It's called Garshad. Launched in 2016, it is a mapping app that allows people in Iran, primarily women, to mark the location of the country's morality police. That way, other people can avoid them. Now the app has been updated to also include the location of riot police. I'm joined from San Francisco by one of the founders of the Garshad app. Firuzeh Mahmoudi is executive director of the human rights group United for Iran. Firuzeh, tell us a little bit more about how the Garshad app actually works.
Garshad essentially allows users to report and view the location of the morality police throughout the country.
Right. So it's crowdsourced, and then wherever those forces are, there's a pin drop, that kind of thing?
Exactly. And if multiple folks, users, use the same point near the same area, they get all clumped together, and users can only report if they're within 500 meter vicinity of a location to avoid spamming by government officials.
I mean, we hear a lot about the morality police. That's actually shorthand for a much longer title. Who are they exactly?
The morality police were created under President Ahmadinejad. Essentially, their role is to ensure that people are being proper, they're using their hijab properly, and they stop. 90% of who they stop are women. And it's essentially one of the government's arms to oppress people using its ideology. And hijab is a physical thing, but it's much more than that. It's a tool of oppression to oppress half of the population. And that's the identity by which the Islamic Republic has built its name on.
I'd like you, Firouzeh, to help us understand what it's like to live with the morality police around you all the time. I know you were once arrested by the morality police. Tell us about that experience.
I left Iran when I was 12. My mother could not leave, so I went back to Iran when I was 16, and I was arrested quite briefly, 5 hours. I had to, my mom and my aunt and my sister, we all went together because they did not want me to go in alone. I had to sign that next time I would get 50 lashes. And then we were released. It's horrifying. You know, like the idea of getting 50 lashes next time, or I was worried I was not going to be able to leave the country because I have a bit of an accent in Farsi. But that is nothing compared to what Iranian women face and fear every day. They don't have body autonomy. Like, they cannot just go out as they wish. The control and the power is not just on their physical body, but it permeates their emotions, their spirit, everything. It's their entire body. They're being oppressed.
Firouzeh, when you think about what is happening in Iran right now, what occurs to you? What occurs to you about right now and the future?
It's heartbreaking to see millions and millions of people oppressed and being forced to lead a life that they don't want. And it's just absolutely heartbreaking. It's also so inspiring. They are incredibly brave, this young new generation. They have no fear in their eyes. I see the fear on the other side, although they're the ones with bullets. One of the chances, there are more of us and there are your bullets. So we don't know exactly how this round is going to go. This protest has turned into an uprising and a movement. And I feel like the genie's out of the bottle. They have no place to go. They've created a situation where they either have to give up their entire identity, which is no longer going to be Islamic Republic, or they are forced to continue oppress, and the people are essentially saying, we're done.
Firouzeh Mahmoudi is executive director of the human rights group United for Iran. She's one of the founders of the Garshad mapping app that helps Iranians avoid the morality and riot police. Firouzeh, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back with more in the next half of the show. You're listening to The World. In the Indian city of Kolkata, a religious festival is being transformed into an international arts exhibit.
You have these young artists who have graduated from art colleges. Many of them actually don't have any kind of lucrative work. Durga Puja is an enormous boon for them.
Durga Puja festival artists get global attention. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We've been following the various turns in the story around the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in May. Earlier this week, we spoke with an investigator from the research group Forensic Architecture. Their team built a computer reconstruction of the spot in the West Bank where Abu Akleh was shot and determined that she was shot by an Israeli marksman and that Abu Akleh was clearly identifiable as a journalist. The report has renewed calls by Democratic lawmakers in Washington to fully investigate what happened. Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen from Maryland has been leading the push and joins us now. Senator, welcome.
Marco, it's good to be with you.
I'd like to begin with what's known as the Leahy Laws, named after Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. The law basically says the U.S. government will not provide assistance to foreign security forces where there is a credible implication of gross violations of human rights. Does the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh activate the Leahy Laws?
Well, that depends on all the facts. And we've been trying to get the facts so that we can have accountability in this case. The most recent analysis that you are reporting on is consistent with analyses done by the New York Times, CNN, the Washington Post. And it's why we keep pushing the Biden administration to conduct an independent analysis of their own, reach their own conclusions about what happened, so that we can consider next steps for accountability. But getting the facts is a prerequisite to applying any of those laws.
What has been the response from the White House to your requests?
Well, so far, the White House and the State Department have not been responsive. Senator Leahy, myself, and others wrote to Secretary Blinken back in July 12th, with a series of questions trying to get the facts in this case. We have yet to get a response. And it's my view that the Biden administration has a duty to get to the bottom of the killing of an American citizen and a journalist, where the Biden administration says a high priority is to protect journalists in conflict zones, that we have to pursue the facts wherever they lead us. That's what Secretary Blinken himself said some time ago, and we're going to continue to hold the administration to that.
You and Senator Leahy have authored an amendment that would force the State Department to issue a report on Shireen Abu Akleh's killing. If the killing were found to be intentional, what would that mean for lawmakers?
Well, again, I just don't want to jump to the conclusions of a report. This is why we keep pushing for the facts. And we are totally, we're not satisfied at all with what the Biden administration has provided. As you probably know, the IDF issued a report claiming that the shooting was justified because there was an ongoing exchange of fire at that time between IDF forces and Palestinian militants. But this most recent evidence, along with the earlier evidence from independent news sources, again, like the New York Times, Washington Post, and others, indicates that there was no such exchange of fire. And this is the key issue we have to resolve. And the Biden administration has a duty to work with us to get the facts.
So given all the sources you have, what other facts are lawmakers looking for?
Well, what we're looking for is for the Biden administration to conduct this independent analysis, because they ultimately are the ones that have to make the determination under U.S. law. So this is why getting the facts is so important, and we're going to continue to push to do that. I also included an amendment in the State Department authorization bill that was passed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee the other day to require the administration to provide us with a copy of a report done by the United States Security Coordinator on the ground there. They have not provided us yet, despite the fact we asked for it back in July.
If a State Department report showed her killing as intentional, would you press to cut funding to Israel?
Well, again, I don't want to get ahead of the facts. Clearly, if that were the case, that would trigger the Leahy laws. Senator Leahy himself made that statement on the floor of the Senate. But that obviously is contingent on the finding of the facts. And this is why it's important that the administration not sweep this under the rug, and we're going to hold their feet to the fire so that they can't do that.
Senator, with some exceptions, there's long been an overarching belief in Congress that the U.S. bond with Israel is unbreakable. Are we at a moment where that's being questioned?
I think it is unbreakable. I think we have a very strong partnership with Israel, which is why it is especially disappointing in this case. That we can't get more facts and cooperation. Secretary Blinken asked the IDF to review their rules of engagement after this case. In other words, review when fire is appropriate and when it's not. He pressed that for a little while, but then he dropped that request when he got some pushback. So we have a close partnership. So this is a moment where, you know, we want the Israeli government to help us get to the bottom of the shooting death of an American citizen and a journalist. And we need the Biden administration to be very focused on getting the facts. Secretary Blinken himself originally called for an independent investigation. Those were his words. We said, yes, we agree. He's backed off. We haven't. We need the Biden administration to do its duty in this case of a killing of an American citizen and journalist.
World leaders and human rights groups have pointed to what they see as a pattern of human rights violations over the years that Israel is responsible for. Why is the death of this Palestinian-American journalist different for Senate Democrats?
Well, all violations of human rights, wherever they happen in the world, are important. What we have here is a situation where you do have an American citizen, a Palestinian-American. You also have a journalist, and the Biden administration has repeatedly said that protecting journalists in conflict areas is one of their top priorities. So if that's true, if protecting journalists is a top priority and protecting American citizens is a top priority, this is a clear case where the Biden administration has to show that it means what it says.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We asked the White House and State Department for a response to Senator Van Hollen's comments. A spokesperson told us that the State Department will continue to press Israel to review its rules of engagement and take additional steps to prevent similar tragedies in the future. They added, the State Department has pressed for a thorough, credible investigation that culminates in accountability. In Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince is now Prime Minister. Mohammed bin Salman, the powerful leader in the kingdom, has a new title. On Tuesday, the Saudi king made a surprise appointment, naming his son head of government. Practically speaking, it won't make much of a difference in terms of who's running the country. Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's known, has been Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler for several years. As the world's Sarah Birnbaum explains, his new title of prime minister is more of a legal maneuver.
The murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018 shocked the world.
Turkey says Saudi Arabia brutally murdered Khashoggi.
World leaders are continuing to push for more information after Saudi officials put forth multiple...
A mockery of justice. Will we ever find out the truth about the journalist's killing?
It was Saudi security agents who murdered Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. He was an outspoken critic of the Saudi government. U.S. intelligence agencies concluded that the killing was approved by the crown prince himself. In 2020, Khashoggi's widow, Khadija Junghiz, brought a civil suit against MBS and other Saudi officials in U.S. court.
Mohammed bin Salman murdered him. We know who is responsible. But we want to hold truth.
The think tank founded by Jamal Khashoggi is called DAWN, which stands for Democracy for the Arab World Now. It's a co-plaintiff in the lawsuit. Sarah Lee Whitson is the executive director.
The Alien Tort Claims Act and the Torture Victims Protection Act allow for lawsuits of people who are killed due to torture, due to gross violations of human rights, when they have a connection to the United States. And of course, Jamal was a U.S.-based journalist, a U.S.-based activist, and that's precisely why Saudi Arabia killed him.
MBS moved to dismiss the lawsuit. He claimed to be entitled to something called head of state immunity, based on his title of crown prince. In July, a U.S. district judge asked the State Department to weigh in. That decision was due August 1st, but the Biden administration asked for an extension. Now, Monday is the deadline. William Dodge worked on issues of foreign official immunity at the U.S. State Department. He says before Tuesday, MBS didn't have a great case.
According to the State Department's past practices, MBS would not have been entitled to head of state immunity because head of state immunity is really just limited to three offices: the head of state, the head of government, and the foreign minister, and MBS held none of those three positions.
But now he does, says Dodge.
As Prime Minister, MBS is now the head of government, and it entitles him to absolute immunity so long as he is in office, which includes immunity for things he did or might have done before he entered office.
At this point, Dodge says the lawsuit against MBS is dead in the water.
It does seem kind of like a get-out-of-jail-free card, but it actually is.
The White House might be breathing a sigh of relief. Biden was in a catch-22. As a candidate, he said he would make MBS pay for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But as president, Joe Biden needs Saudi Arabia, says Yasmin Farouk from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
This relationship is important to the United States of America. It became even more so after Russia invaded Ukraine and there were global geopolitical consequences that the United States has to manage and deal with.
Like encouraging the Saudis to keep pumping oil into global markets. Farouk says that's why the Biden administration was reluctant to refuse immunity for Mohammed bin Salman.
Even if he wasn't promoted to prime minister, the administration would have tried to find a legal way out for MBS.
The plaintiffs in the lawsuit say they're going forward. Dawn's executive director, Sarah Lee Whitson, says even if MBS gets immunity, his 20 co-defendants will not.
The fact of the matter is that if we're able to proceed in our lawsuit against them, we're able to get discovery in this lawsuit against them, we're able to make them testify. All of the harms Mohammed bin Salman seeks to avoid by avoiding this lawsuit will still be present.
It's about justice and accountability, Whitson says. And this court case could establish a full judicial record of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and the role that MBS played in it. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Across the globe, more and more people are becoming gig workers, great for work flexibility, but not ideal for job stability, labor protections, or saving for retirement. In Mexico, the Labor Department wants to do something about that. It's drafted a bill that would force delivery and ride-hailing companies to classify gig workers as formal employees, quite different from the trend in the U.S. Joyce Sadka is here to tell us why things are not the same south of the border. She specializes in Mexican labor law at ITAM, the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México. Joyce, under the proposed bill, what benefits would there be for workers who shift from the gig economy to being formal employees?
So they would have benefits such as getting Social Security, particularly if they have an illness, it would be covered by the Social Security benefits. They would also have fringe benefits that are defined in the Mexican labor law, such as vacation pay or end-of-year bonus.
Would these gig workers have to work a certain number of hours a week to be considered formal employees? I mean, what stipulations would there be?
What I've heard is that they're thinking about two or three classifications of workers, and that will change the level of benefits that you would get. So you could be classified as a full-time worker, or you could be classified as a part-time worker, or you could be classified as something which the Mexican law calls an eventual worker, which is kind of like a temp.
Right. I mean, as you point out, this proposed law was drafted by the Labor Department under Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The proposal has the support of unions, but some gig workers, I understand, do not support it. Why not? What are their reasons?
Because of the lack of flexibility and because of the fact that they may not want to be full-time workers all year, but they may want to do full-time around Christmas. They also may have another job. A lot of people do this gig work on weekends. There is a segment of the gig workers who are not interested in this proposal. And the issue has to do with what economists would call the intensive margin versus the extensive margin. So if I'm going to be a gig worker anyway, and I'm going to be hired for 30 hours a week anyway, and you ask me, do you want to have worker benefits or not, given that the 30 hours are going to be the same and the wage is going to be the same, but do you want to get this extra vacation pay, Social Security, end of year bonus? Of course, I'm going to say yes, right? But if I'm worried that after the law passes, instead of the platform providing me with 30 hours of work, potentially, which I want, is now only going to provide me with 15 hours of work because it's going to become a lot more expensive and less people are going to ask for this service. And therefore, I'm going to get less opportunities on the gig platform. Then maybe I don't want this law to pass. And that's what we call the extensive margin, which is how many of these jobs or how many of these hours will there be if we make it more expensive for the platforms to operate.
Yeah, clearly more details need to be seen. What are the ride-hailing and delivery app companies saying about this proposed legislation? Because it would seem to contradict their entire business model.
certainly a lot of them have expressed concerns. And the concerns are not just about the cost of paying the workers those benefits. It's also all the administrative costs. Because if I have to register in Social Security all the people who enter the platform, but then after a certain period of time where they don't want to provide the service anymore, I have to then do the paperwork with Social Security to get them off my payroll list, then I'm going to be spending all my time putting people on and taking people off. And you have to remember that you have a country where taxes on labor are quite high and where more than 50% of workers in Mexico do not have Social Security and work in informal firms. So in a country like that, when you pass a law like this, you might have an impact that is different from what would happen in a country like the US, where the level of informal work is much less.
Joy Sadka is an expert on Mexican labor law at the Instituto Tecnológico Autónomo de México in Mexico City. Joyce, thanks very much for explaining what's going on with the gig economy there. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
October is when the Indian city of Kolkata celebrates its biggest Hindu religious festival, the five-day Durga Puja. Millions of people hit the streets to honor myriad depictions of the goddess Durga, eat street food, and just hang out with family and friends. This year, the displays and performances began early, framed as an arts festival for international tourists, before the official religious events began. Reporter Sandeep Roy has more from Kolkata.
The sounds of drums at this time of the year in Kolkata mean only one thing. Durga Puja, the festival of the Hindu goddess Durga when she comes home to earth with her family. The festival technically starts Sunday, but Dol Das, a big drum slung across his shoulder, says he's been summoned from his village by the government a few days earlier than usual. This year, the drums are beating a bit early to welcome a different VIP, UNESCO officials and international guests. Durga Puja has just been added to UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage, and the city has been burning midnight oil so the foreign guests can get a preview of Durga Puja, drums and all. Durga Puja is a religious festival, but Dhrubajyoti Bosuvo, secretary of the arts organization Mass Art, says it's more than that.
But end of the day, this is completely an art, art, and art.
He wants the foreign guests to get a sense of how Kolkata gets transformed during the five-day festival.
A city transformed to a public gallery?
2,000 to 3,000 temporary temples to house the goddess spring up on streets, parks, community centers, apartment complexes. I walked down a perfectly ordinary Kolkata street. Houses, corner stores, street dogs, and Vincent van Gogh. His sunflowers nod overhead. Waves of speckled blue paper billow across the street like his starry night, all made of paper and cloth. In the middle sits the goddess, while sacred hymns play on a loop. Ram Kumar De is one of the organizers of this Durga Puja. He says, "We've pulled Starry Night out of the frame and spread it across the whole neighborhood." Durga Puja was once just about the goddess, ten-armed, riding a lion, killing the buffalo demon. The temporary temples or pandals were cookie-cutter boxy structures of cloth and bamboo. Academic Niladri Chatterjee has documented the pujas for years. He says over time he saw Durga Pujas taking on social commentary on hot-button issues.
Literacy, wife beating, domestic violence, rape. When I first saw it, I was very disturbed. I thought, "Dekhi, anondo korte eshi, what is this nonsense?"
But he realized this was a new kind of social messaging via popular art, reaching huge crowds. And the Durga Pujas were getting more creative.
You have these young artists who have graduated from art colleges. Many of them actually don't have any kind of lucrative work. Durga Puja is an enormous boon for them.
The festival is now a major driver of the state's economy, says Debanjan Chakraborty, the director of British Council East and Northeast India, which commissioned a report on it. Its estimate?
Which estimated that the total economic worth of Durga Puja in 2019 was a little over $4.5 billion.
It's not just a festival, it's an industry.
And that's about just a shade under 3% of the state's GDP from a 10-day festival.
It involves all kinds of people, carpenters, electricians, clay workers, food vendors, painters, and drummers. Many get over half their annual income from just one festival. The public art rebranding is giving Durga Puja a before life and an afterlife. During the preview, foreign tourists can enjoy the art without the religious rituals and the choking crowds. Preview organizer Dhrubajyoti Shuvo says he now wants to create a portal to sell Durga Puja artifacts instead of disposing of it as scrap.
The people from the worldwide art-loving people, they will purchase through e-digital auctions.
But this is still not a biennale. There's no curator. Is all this art overshadowing the religion at its core? In a noisy conference room, art historian Topoti Guhathakurta, who prepared the dossier that was presented to UNESCO, says Durga Puja always was a balancing act between faith and exhibition, marked by excess and revelry.
It was never a purely religious, it was always a communitarian space. Now it's becoming more and more of an exhibitionary space.
One of this year's big theme Durga Pujas is a reproduction of the Vatican, with a Hindu goddess inside. Some politicians have called it sacrilegious, but Chakraborty smiles.
The history of art is really rooted in humanity's sense of wonder and trying to make sense of a very chaotic world.
And that's just as true about faith as it is about art. For the world, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
This was News Today in New Zealand.
Ko tīmata te hī koe mai a ngā toi moko Māori moriori hoki I te whenua o Austria.
A Māori newscaster explaining that a museum in Vienna is returning the remains of 64 Māori and Moriori people, indigenous inhabitants of New Zealand's archipelago. A director from Wellington's Te Papa Museum, Arapati Hakiwai, spoke on Tuesday at Vienna's Natural History Museum.
There will be tears of hurt and grief, but there will be tears of joy and happiness.
Tears of hurt and grief, tears of joy and happiness. Hakiwai is Maori and has been urging museums worldwide to return remains and artifacts that have been taken from their homeland. In recent years, other museums in Europe and the U.S. have held similar ceremonies to mark the return of indigenous relics. In 2014, the American Museum of Natural History in New York returned what had once been seen as colonial treasure, but now recognized as sacred. 24 Moriori skeletal remains and 46 Maori skeletal remains. The museum said in a release that these had been acquired in the 19th century when, quote, there was a strong commercial trade in the remains of indigenous people, end quote. A Maori man told New Zealand's News Hub that a change in attitude is overdue.
They've woken up to the fact that's a colonial mindset that happened hundreds of years ago. Well, we're actually in the 2000 periods.
Museums around the globe have begun to take responsibility for what is now seen as a crime. Te Papa Museum in Wellington is easing the transition, serving as a mediator between museum directors and New Zealand's indigenous communities. Earlier this year, Maori and Moriori celebrants welcomed the return of human remains from the Natural History Museum of London. This ritual may be repeated this Sunday when the bones of ancestors held in Vienna will finally come home. That is The World Today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.